From a meeting at the office to a big first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every event. But clothes don't make the man. So why stuff your closet with things that only work for some situations? With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting. Their clothing is understated and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They craft each piece by combining timeless style and modern performance materials, so you can stay looking good and feeling comfortable from morning to evening. No wardrobe changes required. Browse everything from summer-ready tech linen shorts and anti-odor polos to tailored sweats and crews for a night in. They can outfit you for anything, no matter what's on your agenda for the day. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.
This is a true crime in real time update from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
I'm Tony Bruschi, and today we dive headfirst into the twisting labyrinth of the Richard Allen trial, where new forensic revelations, courtroom maneuvers, and confessions collide. We begin with a bloodstain expert called to the stand to untangle a web of evidence, as puzzling as it is grim. He's got 2 decades of experience, and he's trained cops at the Indiana State Police Academy giving seminars on the science of blood spatter. You'd think with a resume that long, and the testimony would be airtight. But as it turns out, science isn't always as clear-cut as we'd like. Here's the thing. Blood behaves predictably. It's measurable, repeatable. Yet in this case, every piece of forensic evidence seems to do anything but follow those rules. According to this expert, one victim, Libby, left a distinctive upside-down L mark on a tree, supposedly created in a moment of agonizing injury. Her arm, he says, slid against the tree to stabilize herself after being slashed. If that sounds clear enough, wait until you hear what happens next. The expert paints a picture of a violent scene, a large pool of blood, spatter patterns on leaves and branches, but here's the problem. No drag marks. None. And yet he claims that Libby's body had to have been dragged either by her arm or her feet to the place where she was found. 2 competing theories, each with its own set of contradictions, and neither one fitting perfectly. Now, picture the jury trying to make sense of that mess. And there's more. The expert goes on to say that there were bloodstains on the bottom of Libby's heel and the back of her calf, which he suggests might mean she stepped into her own blood. But, and this is a big one, that doesn't explain the blood found on the back of her thigh. Try to imagine that. How do you get blood on the back of your thigh from stepping in a pool of it? These are the kind of details that gnaw at the defense team like termites ready to pull the prosecution's case apart at the seams. Then comes the bombshell. Richard Allen's DNA is nowhere to be found. Not on the clothes. Not on the bodies. Not on the scene. And yet, here we are. 7 years after the murders, with Allen sitting at the defendant's table. What's more, the forensic lab admits they didn't send out a lot of evidence for further testing, something the defense pounces on. The jury hears this, and you can almost feel the unease settling in the courtroom, like a fog rolling through an old cemetery. The defense makes their move, tearing into the expert's assumptions. If Libby was dragged by her arm, the blood should have flowed downward from her wounds. But the stains say otherwise, flowing upward, as if her body had been lifted. And there's another twist, no blood on Abby's hands, even though she suffered severe injuries. One plausible explanation, someone may have washed her hands before investigators arrived. It doesn't stop there. Allen's defense team digs into the expert's cross-examination, zeroing in on how blood transfer could have occurred. They argue that any forensic finding in the case is shaky at best, hinting that contamination, whether through evidence mishandling or something worse, might be at play. There's no denying it. Holes are everywhere in this investigation, and the jury is starting to notice. The courtroom murmurs turn louder when it's revealed that Allen's confession wasn't made during a routine interview. It came after his transfer to Westville Prison. Locked up for 23 hours a day, in conditions that would test the limits of any human being. Was it a confession? or was it the rambling of a man slowly losing his mind? The prosecution tries to rally, insisting that Allen's confession aligns with certain details only the killer could know. But here's the catch. Those details may have been shared with Allen by his attorneys during pretrial meetings. Now, it's no longer just a question of guilt, it's a battle of credibility, with the forensic expert's testimony sitting squarely in the crosshairs. And what about the jury? They've heard about blood patterns that don't fit, missing DNA, and questionable interrogation practices, but they've also been told there was a confession. A thin thread of evidence holding together an unraveling case. The jurors are left with one haunting question: is this a man guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? Or is he just a convenient scapegoat? Allen's defense is playing a high-stakes game. They argue that the state, desperate to close a high-profile case, is clutching at straws. From mismatched forensic theories to the absence of Allen's DNA, the defense paints a picture of an investigation riddled with negligence. And with every unanswered question, the doubt in that courtroom grows thicker. But the prosecution isn't backing down. They hint at more revelations to come, banking on the hope that Allen's confession will sway the jury. Confession or no confession, though, science doesn't lie. Or does it? The forensic evidence, or lack thereof, threatens to blow the case wide open. All eyes are now on what's next, as the defense edges closer to dismantling the state's case. Now, we step away from the gritty details and turn toward the deeper questions looming over this trial. The confounding nature of the evidence is only one part of the puzzle. What motivates someone to confess under extreme circumstances, if in fact that confession is reliable? And what does the flawed forensic work say about the broader system at play? These questions aren't just about one man's guilt or innocence. They're about the integrity of the justice process itself. Psychological studies on coerced confessions tell us that under severe mental strain, like extended isolation in Westville Prison, individuals can say anything to escape their circumstances. Richard Allen's defense team claims that his confession is a textbook case of mental deterioration induced by unrelenting pressure and psychological torment. If that's true, his words become less an admission of guilt and more a symptom of survival in a system designed to break him. Then, there's the unsettling possibility of tunnel vision, where investigators, desperate for a resolution, lock onto a suspect and shape the evidence around that narrative. The timeline reveals 7 years of frustration, public pressure, and investigative dead ends. Richard Allen may have been the unfortunate target of that frustration, a suspect placed at the center of a complex, emotionally charged case, not because of the evidence, but in spite of it. Forensic gaps, missteps, and the decision not to test key pieces of evidence point to either carelessness or something more troubling, a rush to closure at any cost. The absence of Allen's DNA is a glaring hole in the state's case, and it forces us to ask, if not him, then who? Could the real killer still be out there walking free while the system fixates on Allen? And what about Abby and Libby's families? 7 years is a long time to wait for answers. But is closure really worth it if the wrong man is punished? The families now find themselves caught in a legal battle where the search for truth has become secondary to courtroom theatrics and procedural entanglements. Ultimately, this trial becomes more than just a fight for justice in the murders of two young girls. It's a test of how far the system is willing to stretch its limits to declare a case closed. The jury sits at the epicenter of it all, carrying the burden of determining whether this is a case of justice finally served or justice derailed. This is not just Richard Allen's fight. It's a reflection of a legal system that, at its core, is supposed to deliver fairness for all. If it fails him today, what's to stop it from failing someone else tomorrow? I'm Tony Bruschi. If you want to stay up to date on this case and others we cover, be sure to subscribe.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.